This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Thanks to Resident Frequency Radio for another show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling or food addictions. Food addictions. You can have them all. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience save lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial, or 3CR on digital radio, or maybe even streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, and I'm joined in the studio today by my guest, Rick, who's going to be sharing his experience of recovery from drugs and alcohol with the help of Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Michael.
No problem at all. So before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Now, before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. So please practice self-care and care of others whilst listening. Welcome, Rick. I already welcomed you, but it's great that you could join me in the studio today. We'd like to start the show by asking our guests to share a little bit about their life, as, you know, growing up. So what was it like in childhood growing up as Rick?
Well, I guess I had a couple of parents that were problems with alcohol. I certainly felt like I was different, you know. I felt less than. There wasn't a lot of love shown. There's no hugging, I love you. So there's no encouraging of self-esteem and self-worth and things like that. So I felt different, and I didn't feel like I could talk about bring up issues and things like that, you know, and I felt less than as a child.
So brothers and sisters, big family?
Yeah, I had a sister that's a year and a half born after myself, a brother that was born 6.5 years after myself, and another brother that was born 14 years after when I was born.
Wow, okay. So, and you grew up in Melbourne?
I grew up in the country. I was at Horsham, Timboola.
Okay, small town.
I started, I think, Dimboola. My mother and father had broken up, and my mother decided to live in Dimboola, away from Horsham, and with my sister and then my brother. And, so we started just to live like that, and,
What was life like at, so were you good at school? Did you go to school? Did you, did you show up?
Yeah, I did show up. I didn't really like school that much. I didn't like being told what to do, and I was probably a little bit rebellious and things like that, and authority figures didn't kind of work for me.
From a young age?
From a young age, and I did hang around for school for long. I left in year nine, so halfway through year nine at nine high school. And back then in the 80s, you'd go in and out of jobs, so you could get a job quite easily those days, and that's kind of what I did.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my experience. I finished school and I'd just swap jobs to jobs to jobs. So so at school, you know, big group of friends,
small friends, probably a few troublemakers, you know, people that stood out as not doing the right thing. So I was probably in between, not to the extreme, but, you know.
Were they attracted to you or you were attracted to them?
I'm not too certain, but, it seemed to be, I don't know for sure,
Okay. So when did you start drinking or taking drugs?
I drank when I was 14 with my uncle at the time, and my first experience is I drank to blackout.
Mm-hmm. And what's a blackout?
A blackout is when you don't remember what you did, but yet your body could continue to keep going. Like it's the automatic.
Remarkable, isn't it?
Automatically pilot kind of thing, you know? Yeah, autopilot,
And most people don't have that. Like that's our experience is that, you know, I can say blackout, and when I'm talking to other people who drink, then they go, yeah, blackout. But I didn't even know what a blackout was until I come to AA and then got told that this is what a blackout was. Oh, Other people don't have that.
Some people, you know, have a drink, get drunk, and go to sleep.
Yeah.
For myself, is I have a blackout. My body keeps going, so I keep doing things like driving cars and, you know, just walking around and doing things that I don't even know I'm doing.
Superpower.
And get into trouble. Superpower until it gets me locked up.
Absolutely. Okay. So your first drink, you had a blackout.
I had a blackout the first drink, and I returned again and had another blackout the following day because it was so good.
So good.
Not that I could remember any of it. My uncle was part of a family of nine, and there was a lot of drugs and alcohol problems all through them. But he was a functioning alcoholic, and my father wasn't a functioning alcoholic. And I thought, oh, he's got it together. He looks pretty good, you know. So I just thought, yeah, he's pretty cool. You know, he's got a wife, he's got a family. It's all
he's got a job.
He's got a job, and that is a big thing. Where my father could never hold a job.
Yep,
kind of thing. So he kind of stood out as, oh yeah. He's pretty manageable, but as a child, that's what I thought, you know.
Yep. So you had your first drink in what, about the same age that you left school?
Yeah, probably around about that same time.
Alcohol has that effect on us. So I think you get this choice. You go, I could do one or the other. Which one will I do? I reckon I'll go with alcohol.
That's right. And when I drank alcohol, you know, I felt this tingly, warm feeling, and I didn't care what people thought. It gave me some confidence that I didn't have, and I didn't feel like I fitted in. I could talk to people, but when I had the alcohol, I could talk. But the problem was that when I drank alcohol, I didn't have one or two. I just continued on and on and on pretty quickly, you know. And
we sort of talk about that phenomenon of craving. It's a language that's spoken in the 12-step fellowships. But this thing that makes me different is that when I put it in my body, I can't control how much I'm going to take. Like the only thing I can guarantee once I start drinking is that I'm going to have another drink.
That's correct.
There's nothing else I can guarantee you except that once I've had one, I'm having a second one.
That's correct.
I have a second one, and even if I'm only planning on having a couple, like it's...
Absolutely.
Because alcohol's an amazing drug. You know, it takes the edge off, it does all this stuff, and if I could stop at a couple, I probably would have stopped at a couple because I only needed really two or three to change the way I felt and I thought.
Yes.
And then, yeah. So you had this experience with alcohol where it changed you. Like, did it light you up? Like, would you say it was a spiritual experience? This thing, and you went, maybe even if you didn't know at the time, but you go, it did change the way you feel, and you found that attractive.
Yeah, I think it was a warm, fuzzy feeling. And initially, when I had it, I had some manageability around it. Like, I held a job. I had to travel on a train to get to do my work, and I come back and I'd go and buy some alcohol because I looked older than I was. So I brought some alcohol, and I was just listening to my music at the end of the night. At the end of the night, drinking some alcohol, listening to music in bed after I worked, and I was pretty manageable for a little while there, but it didn't last very long. At the end of the day,
so what happened then?
I grew up in a dysfunctional family. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes. There are a lot of affairs, lies, this, that, and there's a lot of guilt, shame, and things going on. And it's also just because I felt different and I didn't feel a part of it, I couldn't talk to people, and I really struggled. I just felt that alcohol gave me that bit of confidence. But the problem was that it took over more and more, you know, and like, you know, on my lunch break, I'd go down and I'd scull six drinks and come back to work, you know. Yep. And I said, well, maybe you shouldn't have done that because we can smell alcohol in your breath.
Yep.
But then there got a time when I hit about 17, 17 and a half, where I no longer could go to work and drink. I had to make a choice. Which one was it?
Yeah.
And it was drink. And I was found drunk around town where I should have been at work. And so I got the sack. And across, they talk about this fine white line where you might have been able to drink or drug manageably, but then you cross the fine white line, you can never go back.
Yep.
And I went across, and some people can function and hold jobs and that. I wasn't one of those people.
Yeah.
I just went full on with my drinking, and I could never regain control ever again. And I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't take care of myself. And at probably 17 and a half, my life was completely unmanageable. From, to say, when I first had it at 14, within 3 years, I'd lost control.
And at that time, actually, I imagine in the town you said you came from, like the football and the netball club were pretty big features of the actual town. And so if you're isolated away from that stuff, have you got a friendship group, and or you're doing a lot of this stuff by yourself by now?
I was doing a lot of by myself. My family, even though they had drinking problems, they'd say, oh, look at Ricky, he's pretty bad, and they wouldn't go near me because I'd have all these emotions, all these feelings and dealing with an unhealthy, unmanageable kind of family and things going on, you couldn't talk about it. And when you drank alcohol, it brought all those feelings and emotions and up. And I also just didn't like myself as a person, you know, who I'd become. I couldn't be reliable. I couldn't keep my word. Any self-respect or self-esteem, which I didn't really have anyway, kind of just didn't last. People didn't want to be around me, you know.
Yep. Okay. So so you get to the age of 17, you made a decision that that alcohol was going to be the thing rather than work. And what happened?
Yeah, well, it got completely out of control, you know, and all I did, I was on the dole, I was just drinking. I'd get locked up regularly. We were in a small country town. There used to be a joke going around because we've got a huge family that we paid half the courthouse, you know, and so the police were on the lookout. If it wasn't me, it was another family member. We're a big family. Like, that's my initial family that I told you about, but my father's family was 9 children and they had, you know, children of their own. So half the town and most of them were alcoholics, you know, running around. So they're always on the lookout. The coppers, you know, were busy kind of thing, you know.
There's a Netflix series in it by the sound of it.
It could be, yeah.
Okay. Tell me what got out of it. Got out of control looks like. Are your family, you know, are you living at home with your parents? Are you living by yourself? What are you doing?
Yeah, well, I moved away to work and then I lost my job and then I had to go and live. My father helped me out, but he's an alcoholic also and he was in and out of jail as well. And I was out of control, was, you know, I couldn't stop drinking. I was in a lot of blackouts. I couldn't remember what I did. I'd wake up, the house would be on fire. I'd fall through the ceiling a few times. I'd wake up with blood. I didn't know what was happening. People were filling in the blanks.
Yep.
And usually when you got other alcoholics pointing the finger, they want to make you look pretty bad. So they will tell you a story and you can't back it up because you're in a blackout and you don't know what you've done. So you feel more guilt about yourself and worthless. And I become suicidal. I really hated who I'd become, and I didn't know how to kind of stop because no one around me was stopping. They were all just drinking. Examples.
So what role was drugs playing in your life at that stage?
Well, you know, it started with alcohol and things like that. You know, later on, I'd get a partner who was into drugs and alcohol as well. You know, and I tried. You know, there was medications I tried. She was smoking dope, and it wouldn't be like take one or two and let's just leave the rest. It was let's use it all.
Yep.
And anything, like if I was taking some tablets, I wouldn't look at what will they do for me. I'd just take them and we'll just work. It's a mystery bag, you know. And I robbed a few hospitals and took a few tablets and they said, you're taking Alzheimer's bloody medication, 9 different medications.
Yeah.
And I was at some stage trying to kill myself, you know. I wasn't just because I was in a lot of pain and there was no way out. And, you know, I couldn't see any way out.
And so and that cocktail of drugs and alcohol, what did that do to you physically?
Oh, it certainly destroyed me, you know. It's just weighs you down, blackout. And they say it's like a mini stroke when you have a blackout and things like that. But constantly, like physically, I can do things real angry, you know, have accidents and things like that. As I said, I fell through a ceiling and cut myself a fair few times. I suppose smashing windows or doing something because I hated my life and hated who I'd become. So, and I also did end up slashing up and things like that.
Yeah.
I was self-harming because I was isolated with my head. There didn't seem like any way out and I was in a bad state.
There's a lack of people around that care. Like it sounds like, you know, that there was just you and the world.
Absolutely, you know, yeah. Exactly.
And if it isn't going the way I want it to go, then it's against me. So it's a tough place to be in. We might take a break and we'll come back and we'll play some music and we'll come back and we'll just have a chat and see what happens next. Oh, apologies to Local Food Connections for cutting off their promo. I will play it again in the next break. You're listening to The Living Free on 3CR Community Radio. We would encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor or call the radio station during business hours on 94198377. Today we're talking with Rick about drug addiction and alcoholism and recovery through Narcotics Anonymous and AA. Before the break, you gave us some insight sort of into your introduction to alcohol and drugs, and maybe we'll move forward in time just a little bit and see where you're at when you realise it's a problem and you're wanting to do something about it. What did you try and do to manage the consequences of what was happening?
Well, I guess, as I said, I did become suicidal, and because I turn up in the hospital all the time, they thought, well, this guy's in trouble. And they did send me to rehab and detox, over in Adelaide to get me away from my family. So that's what I tried to just slow down. I didn't really have a concept of, what it was to be a drug addict or alcoholic and have an addiction disease kind of thing. And obviously when I, got there, I saw the word God. I didn't want to have a part of that. And sometimes I get some time up, but also, I had, I'd be addicted to relationships as well. And as soon as somebody gave me a call, I'd run out of the bloody rehab and try to go back. And I didn't change who I was anyway in a unhealthy relationship, So I did try to control it, which I couldn't do, using self-will and things like that. And it never lasted, over periods of time. Yeah.
So did you get to a stage of, hopelessness, or where you sort of go, actually, I can't see any way out of this?
Yeah, well, I think when I was suicidal, I did get to a point, two points. One, I became a father at 22, and I was with my son's mother, who was a drug addict and alcoholic. And when I become a father, a lot changes when you become a parent, because it's not all about you. And fortunately for me, and it doesn't happen for everybody, is that I had to step up for my son. And that really, that really saved my life, because his mother didn't want to do anything about her drug and alcohol problem. And yep. There's a lot of things that go along. You got unhealthy people coming into your life, she'd be ripping people off. They'd be coming looking for their money. And my son was in unsafe, and I was concerned. So what happened is I took my baby son and went to a rehab over in Adelaide with a baby, because two things is I was concerned about his well-being. And the other thing that was strong for me is that I wanted my son to be brought up in a better environment than I was. Yeah. And these were very strong things I had. And I say he saved my life because I didn't have any self-worth or self-esteem. So he was the one, I stood up because he needed me. And that was the driving force at that time to kind of get me to try to make a change and make a difference.
Yeah, I guess in AA or in NA, they don't talk about God so much as a higher power, but this is almost like a higher purpose. There's something outside of me that I can focus on, that it doesn't mean I'm putting myself first, because my experience is that I always come first. Yeah, when I look at my relationships, I always put the bottle first to everything, but to be able to have to put something in between you and drugs or a bottle is awesome.
Well, before I was a parent, it was about self-centered, but I was just running on suicide. I could die, it didn't matter. There was nobody else to be concerned about. Now I had a reason to be concerned about. He's somebody who needed me.
Yeah.
And I felt like I needed to step up. But the thing is, I knew that I could not be a parent if I continued drinking. I had to somehow work in a way that I had to stop drinking and drugging in order to fill that role, and I did, and I'd done rehab and detoxes a number of times, a half a dozen times, and I'd get a few months up, I'd go out, fall in love.
That's the solution.
That's it, fall in love, and then within 2 minutes, I'd be relapsing again, because it'd bring up a lot of emotions and feelings that I couldn't deal with, and that was the natural thing for me, so that was a concern for me as well. So I had to then really focus on making some changes within myself, and that's a process in itself, because dysfunctionability for a long time takes a long time to change,
So that was your last rehab, or you went with your son?
Yes, I think that was, yes. I had to come to Melbourne to do a custody battle. It was for my son against his mother, and I had to get my act together, but she also had to get her act together. And so it dropped me to Melbourne when I locked into doing a lot of NA meetings and some AA meetings. And I just found with AA, there was a lot of older people there, and NA, they seemed a bit more crazier and younger. And I was 22 at the time.
Yep.
And I just seemed to fit into NA a bit more, you know. And they say any minor mood altering substance. So that's drugs or alcohol or anything that really looked at anything, you know. So, yep. And the way I took anything is I just took more of it, you know. There was no limit of one or two. If it's tablets, you take the whole box. If it's dope, you smoke it or whatever. There's no limitation on it.
So you've got some identification. The idea is that we had the meetings that are held in 12-step fellowships are about identification and people telling their stories so that one person hears it and you go, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not Robinson Crusoe here where I'm, you know, sitting out here because I always think I'm the worst person on earth and I'm doing this stuff and there's no one else out there. I'm terminally unique, I think, is the language. And did you find identification when you went there?
Absolutely. I felt different. From the rest of the world. And when I came there, people were talking about how I felt or how I thought. I thought, wow, I feel a part of, finally, I found somewhere I'm a part of. I don't know about getting 10 years clean or sober or whatever, but I knew that these guys spoke my language for first time.
Huge, you know? Relief, isn't it? Your shoulders just, your shoulders just sink down. You go, wow, to sit there in this space and go, my head's not rushing as much because the people I talk to, I might not have exactly the same experiences, but they get me.
Absolutely, yeah. I just felt so different and out of place and for a long time in my life. And, yeah, I come into here and I hear these meetings. In the meetings, these people kind of get me. And I related. Totally.
So what happened from there? So you were, how old were you now? You're about
23? 22. You're 22 and... I was desperate. Like there was no, a lot of people play Monopoly and collect $200. There was no passing, go and collecting $200. It was game over for me.
Yeah.
If I didn't do anything else, I was going to die because I was suicidal for about 3 years before I even got into recovery. I now was a father. I really wanted to do something, you know, to be there for my son. I really wanted to do that. And so what happened was that I was desperate to go to any lengths. Yep. And they talk about going to any lengths. And then we'll suggest, I got into the rooms and they talked about a number of the suggestions they talked about. They talked about doing a lot of meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days.
Yep.
I wasn't working. I wasn't capable of working. So I was doing like 180 or 200. I was doing two or three every day because you can get to that many if you want. Because if I wasn't doing it, I was sitting with my head.
Mm.
So I was desperate. On top of that, I was doing service, you know, if it were, because I didn't have great social skills. So I was doing dishwashing and things like that. So I didn't have to look anybody in the eye.
Yep.
Didn't have any confidence in that until I, you know, then I was opening up meetings. I was chairing meetings. I was, I had to go get a sponsor. A sponsor is a person who's been through the 12 steps, which is a way of looking at yourself and dealing with issues of the past. It also shows you this disease and how it affects you mentally and physically in your mind. And it gives me great awareness on how to deal with my problem. And I had to continue to do that. And supporting others, you know, and, you know, put my hand out to those who put hand, you know, the newcomers and things like that.
So let's go back to the when you said it left you, if you didn't do two or three meetings a day, it left you with a head. Why is that so dangerous? Why is it so dangerous that you're left with your own thinking?
Well, my thinking will tell me anything, and it's a lot very negative thinking, and it will tell me lies. 90% it goes through my head, especially early days, is lies. And it will just talk me into using, again, if it's all the guilt or things that I've done in the past, it will tell me it'll be different this time. It's never different this time.
Yep.
And the insanity of it, you know it's not different, and you go and do it anyway. You know that you're going to be broke. You know you're going to be homeless. You know you don't know what's going to happen. You're still going to go and do it. Now that's insanity.
Yeah, it's like I hear people saying doing the same thing and expecting a different result, but I don't even expect a different result. I just do it and I know what the outcome is going to be, but I got no choice.
That's right.
I mean, it's powerless. The definition of powerlessness, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the fact that I have no choice I'm going to pick up because I don't have a skill set that allows me to do sober or clean.
100%.
You know, and so I keep relying on it because I go, I don't know anything better.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
And in early days, you don't learn that. Like, you just go, okay, yeah. And you watch this cycle of going round and round and round. I make a decision and I'm not going to do it anymore. And then some time passes. I make these firm promises that I'm not going to do it. And then usually it says on the, they have this cycle of addiction when you're in the rooms, and it says there's no time span. And in that no time span, after making this promise that I'm not going to do that again, something happens. And the thing that happens is, for me, is that I usually come in contact with other humans, and they, like, when I'm not using or drinking, what happens is I'm a magnet for people who shit me. And they're everywhere. Mm. And so I got to relieve that, because they start doing things that I don't think they should do, and they're not treating me the way I need to be treated. And so eventually I get irritable and restless and discontented, and I'm not happy about the way the world's working. And I go, I need some relief from this. And my mind's going, my thinking is just going crazy and crazy, crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I pick up again, and I go, oh, I'll get some relief. And this time it'll be different. You're right. My brain lies to me, so. Yeah, so you're in there, you're hearing the stories, you're hanging out. Did you stay clean and sober from that first time?
I got clean and sober for about a year and a half, and in that time, I think I achieved a few things, and I learned a few things, and I grew a little bit, you know.
Yep.
And so I had a relapse, and I don't know, some people don't need to have a relapse, but I had one that was. It's a life thing, you know, learning how to talk to people, how to deal with things, you know, not running on your ego. Life experiences is hard. Yeah. And I just had to understand this disease. I was doing everything, but it just does take time to change, because I destroyed myself for, even though I wasn't, you know, doing it for 20 years, I'd just done it and acted. And I was also brought up in an unhealthy, manageable family. So things that I didn't carry healthy traits into my life. So not setting boundaries, having unhealthy people around and doing things, I'm putting up with stuff, whatever, just didn't help me in the long run, you know.
Yeah, eventually we make a surrender, and eventually my experience is that I take back a little bit of that surrender, because the surrender requires me to ask for help, and then it requires, and one of the key thing of any of these programs is that I need to be honest, and eventually I get dishonest. There's something happens that I'm not willing to talk to someone else about because I'm just going to manage this bit myself, and I have that in cycles in my recovery now, where I take my will back and I run an aspect of my life, and I don't give it to someone else no one else knows about it, but I'm running it, and it creates pain. It just creates pain in a lot, and I can't compartmentalize my life enough to go, I'll just have that bit over there, and I'll have my relationship, I'll look after that, and, you know, God can have my drinking, and you can have my work life, and you can have that, but my relationship, I'll be looking after that. And I get dishonest, and I get things I don't have a skill set for it.
Absolutely, yes.
So you come back. How long did the relapse last?
Fortunately, it only lasted probably a couple of months.
Did you do some real damage in that time? You had your son with you? Or?
I didn't have my son at the time. I was almost there to get custody. So I'd done all the hard work. Yep. They're willing to give him to me. And next minute I relapse. I don't know if it's a sabotage thing or.
It's absolutely in the book, I reckon. It's in the book, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It tells us this important meeting that's coming around that I've been working on for a long period of time. And then I get this moment of insanity right before the outcome of it.
But so I just went and I drank and I used, and then I got a point that I had enough, and then I came back to the meetings. And the important thing they say is that, you know, the doors are always open, and that, you know, I can beat myself up for relapsing, which we all can do that. But the thing is that you don't necessarily get it the first time. And sometimes it takes a number of times to get it. But the thing is that I was determined to get it or die trying. That was only two ways it was going to go down for me. So I continued to go, and because people welcomed me, and they understand. They understand that we're suffering from a disease. They understand that relapse is sometimes a part of recovery, because you don't get it all the time. And because I was able to come back, and I got a bit of time up here and there until I was able, and that took me another year to totally get abstinent. And stop again.
Yeah, like I really like the word relapse rather than bust. I like the fact that, you know, I'm not breaking anything. I'm actually I'm relapsing back into a state of being that I'm used to. I go back to something that I think has worked for my brain. Will tell me has worked for me for all these years, and again it lies to me. And so I go back and then I try again. And but that's great that you've found your way back into the rooms. We might take another break and we'll come back and we'll talk about what life looks like now. So how long sober are you now, sober in Clint?
28 and a half years.
That's forever. Okay, that's awesome. So I will come back and we'll have a chat about that after this song from... You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out our website. Today we're talking, I'm talking with Rick about drug addiction and alcoholism and recovery with the help of both Narcotics and Alcoholics Anonymous. So your life's clean and sober. You've stopped. We just did before the break. You told us you've got a bit of time up now, which is awesome, and life will have changed. So, what was your initial stuff that happened in NA, and what did it look like for you, and what's it look like now?
Well, initial stuff is, I guess I got in at 22, so I was still very immature. And they say when you pick up drugs, you don't emotionally grow. And I picked up at 14, so. And I still had unmanageable kind of behaviours I learned from a toxic upbringing and things like that. So I took them into my relationships and things like that. So it took me a long time to work through some issues as I went along. So it wasn't smooth sailing. I was very insane for a real long time. Just because you don't stop using drugs and alcohol doesn't mean you're a sane person. And I wasn't. And I was very crazy, but very fortunate that I did not pick alcohol or drugs up because I stayed very close to the program. And I guess why I liked NA is they talked about addiction. And I'm an addicted kind of personality. I'm addicted to everything. Anything that feels good, I want more of it.
Yep.
Initially, yes, it is drugs, but there's other things I got addicted to along the way, you know. I picked up a gambling problem. I never even had a gambling problem when I come in, you know.
Yep.
You know, overeating, you know, I overeat, things like that. So there's things that, you know, I just ran with, you know, and things that caused me problems. And so I've had those problems as well, you know, but dealing with life and issues that come up, you know, and dealing with my feelings along the way, you know. And life, it's not testing me, you know. Life is hard. You get good and bad times, you know, and it's not like, why is God testing me and things like that? You know, I don't play victim anymore. I take responsibility through working the program, the steps, you know, and you have people that some people work the steps, some people don't work the steps, and you could be a dry drunk, unhappy with life, wanting to kill everybody and not very happy.
I've been to that meeting.
And then there's recovery. And recovery, what recovery is about, it's about when you work the steps and you have a peace within yourself. So it's not black and white. There is grey. There is flexibility. You can flow with life. You're not so brittle and rigid that things have to be exactly things like that. Recovery allows me that flexibility in life. Things can change and it's not exactly, things don't go to plan sometimes. I can plan the day out. It doesn't mean that it has to fall apart. But early days, yes, I was very stressed and things like that. And it did take a long time. And I was probably insane for at least a decade into not using. I was still insane. So I wasn't using, and I was trying to do the program the best I could, but it takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. For me to really see this disease and how it can affect me, pushing my will, trying to force solutions, trying to force situations in life that wasn't meant to be forced.
Yeah, I know that when things don't work for me, my go-to is to try harder, but it's actually I need to try different.
Yeah,
and because the solution isn't harder, but that's what I go to, and you know, and but then when I look now, we stop looking like alcoholics and addicts. What happens is the people are shocked when we tell them we're alcoholics or addicts. Like in my workplace, I had my employer tell me recently that I bring a sense of calm to my workplace. Like, you're talking about me, right? I don't see that.
Nice.
But that certainly wasn't what it was like. Early recovery, I couldn't sit still. Couldn't sit in one spot. Mm-hmm. I had to be busy. Like busy was the solution.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what does it look like now? What are you doing now in your recovery that keeps you on your toes and keeps you connected? Like, do you have a higher power in your life?
Yeah, I certainly do. You know, and I pray every morning. I hand over to my will because I can be willful. But what I continue to do in my meetings, I do 3 to 4 meetings. I sponsor people. I have a sponsor. So I take people through the steps. If there's a newcomer, I try to talk to the newcomer. It talks about giving back what I've been received. So I stay connected to the solution, which is recovery. If I go too far away, I become insane. And I might not use or anything like that, but I can go off my head and cause a lot of dramas. So I stay close to the solution, and I continue to work this in my life on a daily basis. Now, I don't need to do three meetings a day every day like I used to. I have a life today, and that's because of recovery. And I have to continue to do recovery to keep what I've got, you know. And because when I came into recovery, I had nothing. I was suicidal. I owned nothing. Yeah. I didn't have any self-respect, dignity, self-worth. You know, and now I can be a person of integrity. I can actually do what I say.
Yeah.
And my actions back it up. You know, I'm not doing any shifty stuff. I don't have shame and guilt when I'm doing a false step. There's not that, because I'm not acting dodgy in my life. Mm. I'm doing the right thing, which is aligned to my morals and values as a person.
Yep.
So when I clear up my head and find out what my truth is, I believe as a human being, if I'm acting on my truth, I believe that's God's will. Because we are human beings. Maybe before I'm an addict, I'm a human being. So I get a bit of sanity, find out what feelings mean, find out what I'm feeling, and if I connect that, and hopefully I can, you know, align that, you know. So my life is reasonably boring today, which is very good, because I lived suicidal, a lot of drama, a lot of stress for a long time in my life.
Yep.
And I like boring. I don't like drama. I've done my
lot with it. Yeah. So what does it look like in your relationships? Like, have you got a good relationship? How old is your son now?
My son is 32. My son never saw me drink or use.
Yeah.
And people tell him stories, and he can't believe it.
Yep.
You know, and that's, but I mean, like I said, I was insane at times when I raised him, but I have a great relationship with him. Like, you know, we can talk about stuff and things like that. And there is a respect there, you know.
What about your parents?
My parents, they don't have recovery. Yep. My father, I didn't talk to him for 12 years. We had a falling out. I've recently started talking to him again, because I did a bit of Al-Anon, and I did set some boundaries, and I've had to learn boundaries.
Tell me a bit about Al-Anon there.
Al-Anon is for people who have been affected from alcoholism. Maybe before, if you drink or don't drink, you can be affected when your parents or somebody, a partner or somebody, is drinking, and that affects your life. And if that affects my life, the things that I don't learn when I'm growing up is I don't learn how to set boundaries. I take on stuff. I don't communicate my feelings. I let things push things down. I don't learn how to interact as maybe a normal healthy person does. It's like a volcano, letting things erupt, build up until it erupts.
Yep.
So I need to learn how to communicate. Now, I didn't learn that when I grew up, and not certainly in a healthy way. So Al-Anon, and I've been doing Al-Anon for over a few years now, and that's teaching me to communicate with my partner in a healthy way. And conflict is a part of a relationship, but to have it in a healthy way is something different, rather than, you know, I'm going to pack the car and I'm going to leave the relationship.
Yeah, I'm on my way out.
I'm on my way out.
Always.
And sometimes I've done it in my head. I just haven't done it, you know. I'm probably in the most rewarding relationship at the moment, but yet challenging, because it's the more adult relationship I've ever had, where we actually have to talk about issues when they come up.
Yep.
And that, when I bring issues up, doesn't mean my partner likes those issues.
No.
And I have to speak the truth, and that sometimes causes...
to do that in a kind and loving way is always the challenge. I like it. I need to be honest without being brutal, and I need to be able to be authentic, but I also need to do it in a way that I don't harm others. And that requires me to think about what I'm going to say before I say it.
Absolutely.
And and I don't have that skill of myself.
Like, yes.
I need to learn that somewhere.
That's right.
Because my words just come out of my mouth and I go, oops. I'll be taking that back.
That's right. Mean what I say, but don't be mean. You know, they say that thing. And something, you know, like I had the other day, I had to set a boundary with my partner, and I thought, well, I'll just point out her defects and every problem she has, right? Then I had a bit of moment of sanity, and my head said, hey, wait a minute, maybe you should ring somebody in Al-Anon and run it by them before you have that conversation with your partner.
Oh, good plan.
And it was a good plan, and I did ring them, and we were able to cut out all the other rubbish and leave her alone with her stuff and just set that boundary.
The power of the pause. It's just amazing that when we stop, when we just actually go, actually, if I don't say it right now and I just sit here, like I'm a classic for writing I write a really good email, like I write a really good email in the evening and I don't send it.
Excellent.
And then or a text message, and I read them again in the morning and I run them by somebody else because I'm not so important that everything needs to be done within, you know, 2 or 3 seconds. Like, but I think it is. Like, I need to have an immediate reaction to this. But if I can respond rather than react, you know, my relationship's got heaps better.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's ongoing learning to do that, you know, and I can fall back into that. It's progress, not perfection, you know, and we just do the best we can. And I find that it's a lot better these days, but I've had to learn this stuff, you know, because I grew up, taking on unhealthy behaviours and so I have to learn how to go about things a different way these days.
I was trying to explain to my partner, you know, what Al-Anon was. I was away with Al-Anon and Alcoholics for the weekend at a retreat and explaining that actually as an addict and an alcoholic, I train the people around me to act in a particular way to protect themselves and they end up doing things that are outside their own moral code and they're looking for a solution to that, you know, They have choice how they act, but they love me. They really want to love me, but I don't act in a way that's lovable, and so they need to protect themselves. And it must be immensely hard. I watch them. You know, at least I had alcohol to push my feelings down. I wonder what they had and what they did and what they do. And oh my God, forced in. You know, anyway, that stuff is really. It's groundbreaking for us, you know, to have this an opportunity to be responsible for our actions.
That's right. We've got to look at our own stuff, our own business, rather than focus on others. And just take care of what we need to.
Yeah. So you're doing three meetings a week, 3 or 4 meetings a week. You've got you're obviously sharing some stuff around some fellowships, and life's good.
Life's good, and I do other social groups that aren't even recovery based. I go to the Heart Foundation walks. We do 10-pin bowling with my partner. I do other things. I have other interests and hobbies, and I found out what I like doing, kind of thing, and it's quite relaxing these days.
And the we were talking earlier about the noise in our head. Is that quieting down?
I was saying earlier, I woke up one day and I could hear the birds chirping and there was nothing going on in my head. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Because I used to have the loud voices that were negative, the negative talk all the time. Well, my head would be racing to what's going to happen in a year's time. All this, and I'd get overwhelmed with life or in the past. So learning how to live in the day and not worry about too much in the future and kind of let it go and things like that. But certainly having that clear head today. And a lot of the time, like my partner will say, what are you thinking? I'll say, I'm actually thinking nothing.
Oh, I think it's a man thing. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about nothing.
That's right.
we practice it. Cool. Well, we might wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time today, Alvin.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. We only met a few weeks ago at a meeting that I hadn't been to before, and we were both there for pretty much the same reason, which was quite funny. Like, we're there because it's a meeting, but we were there to sort of find a regular meeting that we could get to. It was been awesome to listen to your story today. That's all the time we've got. We'd like to thank Rick for coming in and to the 3CR Studios for sharing his experience. And I hope you'll join us next. I'll just say if you'd like to find out more about Narcotics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-652-820, or you can go online to na.org.au. Or if you want Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's 1-300-222-222, or you can go to aa.org.au. And I hope you'll be able to join us again next week when Anne will be speaking to a guest about their recovery story. Coming up next, we've got Balamoir, The Spirit of War, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. And join Uncle Choco in the Spirit of War on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR, and we'll take it out. We'll take us out with some more music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.